And by lower respiratory illness, in babies, we're referring to bronchiolitis, which is an inflammation of the lower small airways, and even pneumonia. So those are the children we worry about the most, and those are the children who are driving this tremendous uptick in hospitalizations currently.
We only have a minute, but what can parents do to prevent their babies from getting this illness?
The most important thing I would say is, number one, to keep your children safe and avoid being around a lot of other crowds and avoid being around other ill people. So notably, that is for the most vulnerable population, for our babies, for our former premature infants. If you have a baby under the age of 6 months, now is not a time to go out to the mall with that baby or to be around a lot of people in a crowd environment. Hand washing, making sure your children are up to date on their vaccines, including their influenza and their COVID vaccine. Co-infection is becoming more of an issue. So it is really important to take these common sense precautions to keep children safe and really to keep our healthcare system afloat at this point.
Dr. Christina Probst, we thank you so much for being with us, a pediatrician in Houston, Texas. Tune in on November 8th for our three-hour election night special. We'll begin broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.fm, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Spark Plug. Stunning, new sounds every other Wednesday 3 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. Join us and get connected.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio Network and affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. Mark Levin, director of the new Al Jazeera documentary film, Freeway Crackin' the System, joined us in studio. In the early 1980s, crack cocaine made its U.S. debut on the streets of South Los Angeles, wreaking havoc on an already vulnerable black community suffering from police repression depression and economic depression, from the rise of freeway Ricky Ross, who made his name as a prolific drug dealer, to the connection between the CIA, the Reagan administration, and Nicaraguan drug traffickers. Mark Levin joined us to discuss this underreported, misrepresented, and often ignored chapter of U.S. history. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The Kremlin says Russia's President Vladimir Putin has monitored drills of the country's strategic nuclear forces. This comes as Ukraine and Russia charge each other of nuclear weapons plans. Eileen Alfandari has more.
Ukrainian nuclear officials said they assumed Russia was preparing a terrorist act using nuclear materials and radioactive waste stored at Europe's largest nuclear power plant at Zaporizhzhia. Russia had no immediate response to the charges, but it did have charges of its own, which it leveled at a closed-door meeting of the UN Security Council. Afterwards, Russia's deputy UN ambassador Dmitry Polyansky repeated the claim that Ukraine is itself preparing a so-called dirty bomb that would spread radiation and is planning to falsely blame Russia for it.
The task of the Ukrainian regime now is to get NATO directly involved in confrontation with Russia. What will happen if there is a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia? I think you have imagination to assume yourself.
A reporter asked President Biden what the U.S. response would be if Russia spread radiation through a dirty bomb or used a tactical battlefield nuclear weapon in Ukraine.
Russia would be making an incredibly serious mistake.
Ukraine has invited the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the labs where Russia charges the Ukrainians are assembling a dirty bomb. Russia asked the Security Council to establish a commission to investigate its claims that the U.S. and Ukraine are violating the convention prohibiting the use of biological weapons at labs in Ukraine. That proposal will be discussed at the UN Security Council on Thursday. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
Russia has targeted more than 40 villages around Ukraine over the past day, killing at least two more people, forcing many into bomb shelters. Former Black Panther and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal gets a new hearing in Pennsylvania today, whether he should get a new trial after presenting new evidence that counters his conviction for killing a police officer more than 40 years ago. Abu-Jamal has maintained his innocence. The new evidence comes from six boxes found in a storage room in Philadelphia's district attorney's office in 2018 with Abu-Jamal's name on it that were never presented to his defense. In it, documents include evidence suggesting authorities bribed two key defendants, one who repeatedly asked for payment after the case and another with a criminal background who received favorable treatment. Another piece of evidence presented is a paper with jurors' names on it, with the letters W and B next to names of white and black jurors, indicating blacks could be excluded from Abu-Jamal's jury, which is a federal crime. It may be his last attempt to secure freedom. Jamal was moved from death row after health challenges and is now serving life without parole. Civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump says a San Antonio, Texas police officer racially profiled a teenage boy before shooting at him 10 times. Eric Cantu is now fighting for his life. Police said Officer James Brennan was responding to an unrelated disturbance when he saw Cantu inside his car at a McDonald's parking lot eating a hamburger. Crump said the family was told their 17-year-old had the same haircut as a suspect the rookie officer had tried to stop a day before.
See profile. This young Hispanic teenager. There's no question about it, about what the officer said from his own words. It was a Hispanic kid with a bowl-shaped haircut. That's it. That's why we're here. That's why he shot 10 times. 10 times.
Police said Brennan violated his training and police procedures when he advanced on the car, opened the door, and told Cantu to get out. Cantu tried to back up and drive away from the car with the door open. Brennan opened fire. After the shooting, the San Antonio officer was fired and charged with two counts of aggravated assault by a public official. Cantu's mother says she doesn't know how many times her son was shot, but he was wounded in the stomach, diaphragm, lungs, liver, and arm. She said four bullets were found in his body, including one lodged near his heart. Police say the 19-year-old former student who killed a PE teacher and a 15-year-old girl at a St. Louis high school was armed with an AR-15-style rifle and what appeared to be more than 600 rounds of ammunition. Orlando Harris also wounded seven other students. Police killed him in an exchange of gunfire. Harris also left behind a handwritten note in his car offering an explanation for the shooting at Central Visual and Performing Arts High School. Police Commissioner Michael Sack read from the note.
Don't have any friends. I don't have any family. I've never had a girlfriend. I've never had a social life. I've been an isolated loner my entire life. This was the perfect storm for a mass shooter. End quote. So in reading this, we could see, you know, some of what's going on inside his mind. He feels isolated, he feels alone, quite possibly angry and resentful of others who have what appeared to him to be healthy relationships, and so a desire to lash out.
A database of school shootings reports this year's total has hit record highs. The K-12 school shooting database reports 257 school shootings so far this year. That's seven more than all of last year, which was an all-time high then. It also shows a near exponential increase in school shootings each year since 2010. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. We now go to our discussion with Mark Levin, director of the new documentary film Freeway: Crack in the System. Mark Levin is an award-winning journalist and independent filmmaker. He has won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, the Camera d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, three National Emmys, and four DuPont Columbia Awards. We now go to our interview. I am sitting in studio with award-winning filmmaker Mark Levin. He has a brand new film entitled Freeway: Crack in the System. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Okay, so Freeway, Ricky Ross, very controversial, of course, and likely known not only in Southern California, where he was involved in the drug trade and well known for spreading crack cocaine in Southern California, but also in other cities around the nation. So before I have you weigh in on that, let's go to a clip from the film Freeway: Crack in the System.
Well, at one time I felt that selling cocaine was my purpose.
We was starving, just looking for a way to succeed.
The first time I seen rock cocaine was 1980.
Murder rate was sky high.
South of the 10 freeway was kind of a no man's land.
So, you know, we're selling it to the blacks. He said, you go into these neighborhoods, there's no cops, you can sell it where you want, and when they start killing each other, nobody cares.
I was going through like $1 million worth of drugs just about every day.
That's like gold. We can make a fortune.
He was maybe the biggest guy in LA.
Rick. Freeway Rick.
Freeway Rick was getting his dope from a very big operator. I think we're into something that's bigger than us, something we really can't deal with.
They had been trafficking on behalf of the United States government.
She could prove what she was saying.
The story was mind-boggling.
When I was young, let me tell you how it was where I come from.
As I've said before, no drug network will remain alive.
There's a lot of people who think that, you know, I made that whole thing up. What they don't realize is the CIA admitted it.
See, I didn't know until I was sitting in prison how valuable an education was.
Yeah, drugs suck. Drugs are really bad. But the drug war is worse.
You want to know a version of hell, be the only guy playing straight in a dirty card game. And that's what the drug war is.
There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980.
Me being here is defying all odds. People don't get federal life sentences and beat them.
We've been spending billions and billions and billions of dollars every year on this war on drugs to find out that the government was involved. That's pretty astonishing.
Cracking the system.
Even if the government just turned a blind eye and didn't do anything about it, then you have to start questioning the whole system.
So there you go. Mark Levin, why this story?
Well, this is kind of almost like a PhD, a summary of a lot of the work I've been doing for the last 3 decades. I was at the Iran-Contra hearings as a young producer for Bill Moyers. I was there when Ollie North testified. 10 years later, I had a crew here in L.A. when the director of the CIA came here in the town, and Deutsch did the town hall meeting about crack. After that, I met Gary Webb. He came to my studio in New York, and I was very impressed by the work he was doing, and he kind of introduced me to Rick. I met Rick when he was in prison at Texarkana. So this is a story, the drug war. I did the film Banging in Little Rock, Gang War Banging in Little Rock, Thug Life in D.C., Slam. A lot of my films have dealt with the fallout of the war on drugs. And I think we maybe are finally at a tipping point where both sides, conservative and progressives, have come to the conclusion that this war is a disaster. And it's at the root of so many of our problems, just like what we're seeing today, from Ferguson to Staten Island, the militarization of the police, guns on the street, really a war on the home front in the name of trying to get rid of drugs. So this is, as a child of the 60s, has somehow been a theme through all my work.
What point did you know about the CIA crack cocaine connection?
When I was at the hearings, the Iran-Contra hearings back in 86, 87, there were demonstrators that had signs that said CIA equals crack in America. So that was like the first I began to hear the rumors.
That was just a little hint, right?
Yep. And there were some journalists, some brave journalists for AP and others who were already kind of looking into who were our allies in these civil wars in Central and Latin America.
Robert Parry's work early.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was one that was there first. And even in the show I worked on, which was The Secret Government, Bill Moyers' essay on Iran-Contra, we had included a small section on this whole question of the intelligence community's involvement with so-called freedom fighters or insurgents, but who were involved in criminality, including drug trafficking, because it happened in Vietnam, Central America, Afghanistan. So there was a general knowledge. But it wasn't really till 10 years later and Gary Webb came along that the specifics of there's this story here in L.A., there was this young kid that was a tennis player, Freeway Rick Ross. And the funny thing is that's kind of how he and I first bonded, because I happened to love tennis and be a tennis player. And so when we found out, I would talk to him on the phone. He was in prison. And we found this common love. He used to challenge me. You know, I'll come on out here. There's one tennis court at Texarkana, and I'm going to whip your butt. You know, you're some middle-aged guy. And, you know, I was quite a player back in the day. By the time I made it out there, sadly, the Bush administration had decided that that was a luxury, that prisoners didn't deserve a tennis court. So it was closed. And it wasn't until Rick got out of prison in 2009 that we actually took the court together here at one of the fancy clubs in Pacific Palisades.
All righty. Well, now would be a good time for us to hear a roundup from a Congressional Black Caucus hearing that was done. And I think it was Jesse Jackson Jr. at the time who sort of gave a summary of what the situation was. Let's hear that now, and you could tell us if that is as it was as far as you know.
Here are the facts. In 1974, crack cocaine makes its first documented appearance in California. The same year, the influential Meneses family in Nicaragua establishes a relationship with the Colombian drug sellers. Between 1975 and 1979, Norwin Meneses is suspected of smuggling stolen cars from California to Central America and shipping cocaine to New Orleans and the West Coast. Sandinista Revolution Forces, Meneses, and others close to the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship, and it causes them to flee into South Central Los Angeles. Rick Ross sees his first rock of crack cocaine in December of 1979. Shortly after this, Congress is warned of a looming crack epidemic. In 1980, groups of soldiers loyal to Somoza begin forming in Honduras and Guatemala and later coalesce to form the FDN, a CIA-sponsored guerrilla army known to the world as the Contras. Ross begins selling small amounts of powder cocaine in Black Los Angeles. In 1981 and 1982, Ronald Reagan authorizes covert CIA support for the Contras. Meneses and former Nicaraguan government officials Danielo Blandón meet with the CIA's military chief in Honduras to discuss fundraising efforts. Blandón and other Nicaraguans establish a cocaine sales operation in Los Angeles. Ross and Blandón meet and begin rapidly dealing and escalating the amounts of cocaine in African-American communities, mostly to dealers and to street gangs. In 1983, in response to customer demands, Ross begins marketing ready-made crack and learns how to turn a kilo of powder into three or more kilos of rock by adding an anesthetic called procaine, a process known as blow-up. His drug network expands to other states. Between 1984 and 1985, Ross and Blandón are selling 100 kilos of Meneses cocaine a week in Los Angeles. The drug gangs who distribute their cocaine begin buying assault weapons and communications gear from Blandón and his associates. Brothers and sisters, I have a very brief commentary, a commentary that comes from one of the great philosophers in our community. Last year, we imported more than $180 billion worth of illegal drugs into this nation. There is something wrong with our national will when we can stop one cigar from coming in from Cuba and can't find $180 billion worth of illegal drugs. What is our caucus calling upon? The Congressional Black Caucus is calling on the administration to provide those interested members of Congress the opportunity to review CIA and DEA files that contain pertinent information on the CIA's involvement in this conspiracy.
So did Jesse Jackson Jr. get that right?
I think he did. I mean, that's a great clip. I would really only take issue with the very last line, because this is something that, as you saw in my film, the question of conspiracy mm-hmm. has been thrown around, and with good reason, but it's also, as a professor in the film explains, it's allowed some of the authorities to kind of slip away from the responsibility. I would say it's more complicity. In other words, that this series of events, I think, is very accurate. But I don't think it was a conspiracy in the sense of the CIA, the White House, the national security apparatus planning to let's bring in cocaine and poison African-American communities, and we'll use that money to fund the Contras. It was more like the Congress turned against the Contras because of human rights violations, and they had little popular support. And the Reagan administration was determined to support them anyway. So it was basically find a way to get them money, even if it means selling arms to Iran, which was illegal as a terrorist nation, or some of our allies getting in the cocaine business. I would sum it up by, on one hand, the Reagan administration was saying to young people, just say no. On the other hand, they were saying, we just don't know about what our allies in Nicaragua, in Latin America are doing, when they did know. And that knowledge, and looking the other way, and allowing it and facilitating it, it's not so much a conspiracy as complicity, but when you are complicit in a crime, you are liable for the underlying crime. And there are many people in prison today on drug charges who were not drug dealers. In fact, girlfriends of dealers who wouldn't cooperate, and they were put away because they facilitated. They answered the phone, or they said their boyfriend should meet somebody, and federal prosecutors used that to put them away for years. So in that sense, the U.S. government, the intelligence community is liable, but I would say it's complicit instead of a conspiracy.
Right. Well, complicit, conspiracy, I mean, I take your point. The reality is, though, somebody knew this was happening.
Absolutely.
And they turned a blind eye to it.
That is right.
So you can call it whatever you like. And to just help our listeners along, we've made reference to the Contras. And, of course, there was a war going on in Central America, in Nicaragua. And the U.S. was determined to quote-unquote, fight communism from coming into the Americas. And they were supporting a group of human rights violators, as far as I could remember and recall, called the Contras, who were fighting against the Sandinistas, who were more to the left, or to the left. So when we refer to the Contras, that's what we're talking about, and the Contra War.
One of the great historic ironies is when I went down to Nicaragua 2 years ago, who's president of Nicaragua, freely elected president?
Right.
Daniel Ortega, the leader of the Sandinistas, who we were told would, if he ever got power, would be marching up Sunset Strip and, you know, turning California communist. Mm-hmm. And he's now the freely elected president of Nicaragua, which ironically has one of the lower crime rates. You know, we saw this whole immigration from Guatemala.
Yeah, the children coming crossing the border.
And Nicaragua is a very poor country, but it has one of the lowest crime rates in Central America. So the legacy of this madness, and that's what attracted me to this story, was that I feel it's like a primary source. It's Common had a line, I think, from one of his raps that was, "We're all children of crack." Mm-hmm. The crack era has spawned really a culture that we've all lived with. The mass incarceration is part of it, the gangster rap,
and
the gang
still,
spreading.
And we are still living with it. I would like now to go to a clip from your film. And in this clip, you're going to hear the voice of President Reagan. And you'll also hear one of Ricky Ross's partners talking about the situation in South LA and the devastation of the community. Let's go to that clip right now.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
1980, Reaganomics, very limited opportunities for young African American men.
There was the demise of middle class manufacturing jobs that had sustained a lot of families. It was at a certain point decided that south of the 10 freeway was kind of a no man's land and off limits, to the point that when crack is arriving in the early 80s, there wasn't much of an economy left to speak of.
We was starving and was just trying, we were just looking for a way to succeed.
When I saw a movie called Superfly, he was probably the most successful black guy that I'd ever saw. This guy stuck in my mind so heavily. I mean, it was like it became a burning desire in my heart to be like this guy. So that started me to be interested in cocaine. I stayed on Figueroa, so, you know, I was around the pimps.
Had a bunch of prostitutes out there hustling for me, you know what I'm saying? Nice Cadillacs. Bunch of jewelry. I bought and sold jewelry, kept my palm down. I spent at least $100 a week on my hair. Rick's cousin Vita introduced us. She had told me about her cousin Rick, that he wanted to make some serious money. And so we talked, and about a month later we got together and started hustling.
Friday night on the
I'm starting to hear now about cocaine, so my ears is perked. Then one day, one of my friends had called me, and he was like, man, I just got back from school. I'm over at my house, come by. Because he knows that I'm looking for a hustle.
A friend said, man, you know what? This is going to be the next thing right here.
He said, man, this thing is the next thing since sliced white bread. You know, I was like, what? So he lays out on the table. He said, man, this is cocaine. He said, well, just take one with you. It's worth $50. I ran into one of my partners who was a pimp, and he said, come on, I'm going to take you and find out what it is.
$25 on a little old green rocket. I was hustling, and I like money.
He beat me out my first pack.
All right, and you heard the voice of Freeway Ricky Ross there. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest in studio is Mark Levin, who is the producer, director, writer of a brand new film, Freeway Crack in the System. I wanted to play that clip because it gave a context of what was going on in the a community that was devastated. Not a lot there for young people. Industry had fled. COINTELPRO had come in, and the more militant of the black movements, the Black Panther Party, et cetera, were pretty much decimated. Looking at that context, how do you want this story to be used?
Well, I think two ways, really. One is you got to know your history to kind of plot what's the next step.
Yeah.
And I see this as the primary tale of the crack era. And so much is connected to it. In a crazy way, Rick Ross is almost like the Forrest Gump of the drug war. In other words, his story converges with so many different elements from the deindustrialization and the globalization mm-hmm. of the economy, where working class and poor workers who used to work in factories and other jobs, all of a sudden, like you said, there was no work.
Right.
It was being sent to around the world, other places, to do it cheaper. And another point, the kind of infiltration and destruction of the militant black movement.
Mm-hmm.
So you were left with street gangs, but that had lost kind of a political consciousness and now got into the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the weapons coming in. So you have the arming of both the street gangs and the police, the militarization.
And one has to wonder where those weapons were coming from.
That's true. And some of them, I mean, as you saw in our film, were coming from the same people that were fighting these wars and that were in the armed business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Blandone was selling weapons and to Rick and others. Then you have the birth of a culture that came out of this trade, which was gangster rap, which was born here. I mean, hip-hop had already been spawned from New York, but the gangster rap
was
culture.
Born in Southern California.
That's right.
South L.A.
That's right. So you have this culture emerging. Then you have the punitive side, the mass incarceration, the fact that all of a sudden, without an economy to sustain young African Americans in their neighborhoods, you have all of a sudden, let's make them part of a prison industrial economy while this underground economy is working. So I see this as fundamental tale that you have to understand to try to figure out where do we go post-Ferguson and post, you know, Obama. Where are we headed? And that's the other side of it, which I would say, is that if you want to just reduce this to, as the film starts, a man in prison facing life without parole, and at the end, a man who's free and is talking to young people around the country, it's about education. It's about learning to think for yourself, as Rick says, critical thinking. The idea that Rick, and I was blown away when I found out that he was illiterate, when $1 to $3 million a day was running through his organization in the early 80s, and that he learned in prison how to read, and that became the weapon, and he lived in the law library, and on his own he found case history to challenge. And when I met Rick in 2006, he was telling me about his appeal to his case. And, you know, I thought, wow, he's, you know, and I'd been sending him books and, you know, he knows more about the law than I do. But I also knew the chances of overturning a federal life without parole sentence under the Bush administration was like 1 in 1,000.
Mm.
And he had that optimism, so that learning and that, you know, beginning to think for yourself and the beginning to analyze how the world works, that actually freed him. And it wasn't just some, oh, this is the right thing to do or this is the politically correct. This was survival. And so when he goes around now and talks to young people, he can reach people that many other teachers, mentors can't reach. And I think that's the other part of this, is how do you mobilize those that we cast away or those that we imprison or those that we haven't had a place for, and actually use the experience they have to help us take the next step forward? Cornell, who was in the film and became one of the major heads of a gang intervention program here under Pete Carroll, here in L.A. Norm, the idea that it's like the AA movement and the NA movement. In other words, people that have been in the game but who bring that knowledge to make up for it and to try to help young people see there's another future and there are other ways of going and there are other ways of making it. That's, I think, the other side.
The film also shows, and the guys that you mentioned, Cornell, Norm, the rest of them, they talk about that kind of lifestyle and the riches that they were able to get. And then there's a woman in the film also saying that, well, Ricky, he was really trying to spread some happiness around and you know, spread some money around so people would have something.
Well, I think two things. First, going back to the clip you just played, if you want to be brutal, you could say that the gangster rap culture really was a distillation of the Reagan-Thatcher ideology, which is the law of the market, the law of the jungle, do or die. That is one of the ironies, you know, historic ironies, that these kids actually internalized the prevalent ethos of the time.
We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we continue our discussion with independent journalist and filmmaker Mark Levin, director of the new documentary Freeway, Cracking the System. He joined us in studio a couple of weeks ago. We'll be right back. This is Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners, and you could check us out at www.sotrueradio.org and look for us on Facebook. If you're a member, please like and friend us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. We now continue our discussion with Mark Levin, director of the brand new documentary film Freeway, Cracking the System. One of the things that the film also exposes is a kind of entrenched corruption in law enforcement and kind of how it happened. And you mentioned Juarez. And I want to play a clip and then have you comment on that.
You had no idea what you were going to come into. Everybody carried extra firepower. And I carried an AR-15 in my trunk with 330 round magazines. At the time, we were coming up with hundreds and thousands of dollars. Okay, you'd get into a location, there'd be a closet filled with money. The federal government started seizing the money. Then the way they worked it out, that money was given back to the agency that seized it. Then that agency would use the money to fight the battle on drugs, supposedly. Captain had a meeting with us and he said, you know, if you want to keep your job, you keep taking that money because the sheriff's department needs it. The focus left, get the dope off the street to get as much money as you can and bring it in. The guy said, you know what? We got $500,000 here we're going to turn into evidence. What's going to happen to it? The first time I was given money, I'm in the parking lot, guy walks up to me, one of my partners, and he says, here, this is your share. I look in the paper bag and there's the money. And that's when I'm thinking, okay, what the hell do I do? Do I take it and stay part of the crew? Do I say, no, I don't want this? And then I get labeled a snitch. Took the bag, stuck it under the seat. Now, once you've done that, you're dirty. There's no going back.
I wanted to get some response to you on this because Ferguson has happened, right? Protests broke all across the country. Now we have no indictment in New York City. The black man died in a chokehold. That was on video, you know, for people to see. You have the 12-year-old who was shot and killed in Cleveland, Ohio. And before that, of course, you had Trayvon Martin. So you now have a whole generation of young people who are building a movement that they seem determined not to let go, that focuses and makes the point on Black Lives Matter, but also on police illegality and corruption and racism. In this particular instance, in your film, it is about that corruption that happens, you know, within law enforcement. So this is another aspect that your film brings out.
And Robert Juarez, who was one of the top undercover cops in the sheriff's department, had never spoken about this before. He went to prison on charges of corruption.
He had never spoken
never
about
spoken,
this.
Not uh-huh. even to his own family.
Wow.
So this was really quite a big moment in shooting the film. He and Rick meet in a scene also. What's amazing, though, is I met someone from the L.A. Police Department who was at the screening and said that they have now invited Juarez to start lecturing to cadets. And I saw de Blasio made a comment also about, you know, we have to look at how we train our police force. Mm-hmm. So the idea that they're bringing a cop who went dirty, as he mm-hmm. said, once you take that money, you're dirty. There's no going back.
No going back.
And that he's actually being used to try to educate new police officers about how to try to avoid being corrupt. And again, look at the war on drugs, where you were encouraged to, you know, barge into houses, you know, almost use tanks. You know, you had what did they call it? You know, where they rammed the doors.
Yeah,
you know,
battering rams.
They had the battering rams. They had the helicopters. You know, it was a military operation. So, and these cops, look, from their point of view, when they would see 14 and 15-year-old kids with automatic weapons and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the closet, they first would rationalize, I'm not going to be corrupt. I'm just going to take a little of the money because look at the gun I have. I got a police revolver, and these kids got automatic weapons, so I'm going to buy an automatic weapon. So it's rationalized. You know, I'm just doing this to protect myself, and the government doesn't have the money. So
a little corruption for a good cause.
Exactly. And then it grows from there. You know, I could use a new car, too, and then a new house, and as Juarez explains it. So, again, the idea of somebody who was in it, in the game, was corrupt, a law enforcement officer, but who is willing now to address and admit what happened and try to be a teacher to younger people interested in law enforcement. That's another model that maybe can be used. And I think that a lot of police forces are going to be searching for how do we educate and train young law enforcement officers not to be occupiers and not to be a military force that terrorizes our own people.
I suspect that if crack cocaine was being moved around in a more affluent white community, the eyes that turned the other way might not have turned the other way. But this is an impoverished community of color, black community, so perhaps those lives are devalued. So if there's some black folks, you know, killing themselves, shooting themselves up and going out on crack, you know, who cares?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I think that's the legacy we all have lived with of you know, of slavery, of racism, of Jim Crow. Black life is cheap. And again, going back to the prevailing ideology, which is, hey, poor people, the rejection of the Great Society, the rejection of the idea that the government or there's a common good, everybody's out for themselves. So if you don't make it, it's your fault. Mm-hmm. You know, and these poor people who don't make it, hey, that's on them. You know, we don't have any responsibility, and you know, and we're not going to look that closely, you know, at what happens. This is a mindset that has got to change, not only because of the devastation we've done, but look at the world. I'm talking about the globe, mm-hmm. the environment. You can't keep going, you know, destroying things like that, and then wake up one day and realize, hey, you know, you thought. You know, you were the 1%, or you were living in your gilded cage and whatever, and there's no air to breathe, there's no water to drink, you know. So I think that's the great challenge, is how do we make that turn to a society where, again, the concept of common good means something, the concept of sustainability and not destroying lives, you know, only the winners, what some have called it, the winner-take-all, you know, mm-hmm. society, economy. And it's a huge challenge. Huge, huge challenge, and it's the challenge of this young generation you're talking about. And yes, the advice can come from some of the older generation of the 60s and the 70s, but this generation's got to find its own way. It's got to find its own voice. I just hope that this film can help, because what's amazing is you mentioned...
Because they have to know this story.
They don't know what Iran-Contra is. And if you mention Reagan, it's basically just, oh, wasn't he that great president? Even Obama, you know, respects him, and everybody says he was so great. You know, and it's funny, there was a big piece in Salon magazine, which was the hip-hop nightmare of Reagan administration, and it was an article about Kill the Messenger and mm-hmm. our film Freeway, Crack in the System, that said, you know, all of a sudden the other side of what Reaganism was all about has reemerged. It wasn't such a great moment, you know, that many have held it up to be. So you mm-hmm. can't have young people who've got to find their voice and their way not knowing what really went down, not knowing what Iran-Contra even was, or who Reagan was, or Ollie North, or any of these situations. You got to have that in your kind of vocabulary so that you can figure out, okay, what is that next step on your own?
And how crack came into the U.S. and into South L.A. and then across the nation. Our guest is Mark Levin, a brand new film, Freeway, Crack in the System. We're discussing this now. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You know, on that note, I want to talk a little bit about this Nicaragua connection, going back to the Contras, because you hear the name Blandón quite a lot in the film. Tell us a little bit about Blandón, because he was a key figure with the Nicaragua connection. And then you also made a journey to visit with Blandón.
I did.
I want us to have some time for you to talk about that.
All right. Well, you know, I really haven't spoken publicly about this before, but I think now is a good...
So this is the first time, folks.
That's true. Mm-hmm. This is a good moment. I had said to myself, I think, at the beginning of this journey when Rick got out back in 2009, I'm going to find Blandón. Mm. That was a personal just mission.
You were going to hunt him down.
I was going to hunt him down. And through... someone Rick introduced me to, a Nicaraguan American, he led me to Nicaragua, and he was a very unusual guide because his father had been a national hero. He was the baseball manager of the Nicaraguan team when, in 1972 or 3, they beat Cuba. And that was a high point in Nicaraguan history, when they beat Cuba. So their baseball stadiums with his statue, and he was my guide. I went down there with him. And so that was, I could have only navigated this because he was respected by ex-Sandinistas and ex-Contras. He could move between those
worlds.
And he tracked, Blandón had told me, come on down, you know, I'll show you around. But of course I got there and, you know, we made a time to meet at a certain place and where is he? He's not here. And then we made mm-hmm. a plan to meet at another place and where is he? He's not there. So Alex, you know, kind of helped me track him down. We went to the lumber yard where he has an exotic lumber business in an industrial part of Managua. And we literally sat in the car. And, you know, some guys came out, what are you doing? And we said, oh, you know, Danilo has, you know, told us to meet him here. He invited me down. And we'll just wait for him. You know, they said, he's not here. We'll just wait. And we did. We waited a few hours. And finally, someone came back and they said, commit here, and we went into a trailer on the grounds of this lumber yard. And there was a very casually, but there was a certain aristocratic sense. I don't know if you ever heard of the Spanish actor Fernando Rey. Was in a lot of Buñuel films, but he reminded me, you know.
He had a presence,
and there were maps of the jungles and wood all over. And he looked at me and he said, "Gary Webb tried to find me. Congresswoman Maxine Waters tried to find me. Film director Oliver Stone tried to find me. You found me." And that's how it started. Now, there was tense. There was, you know, the three of us, and he had someone outside. Because you can imagine there was some suspicion. You know, I told him I was working with Rick, you know.
And he was a major drug dealer,
and
right?
working
with the CIA.
And he had betrayed Rick. He set Rick up.
Set him up and
sent him away and testified against him and sent him away for life without parole. So he was definitely suspicious that our mission wasn't a filmmaker's mission. It might have been a hit squad or something coming after him to finally get revenge. So the fact that Alex was there again and could say, "Oh, my father," and they started talking in Spanish, and that broke the ice, which was key. Then I said to him, you know, obviously, right off the bat, you know, "You betrayed Rick. Why?" And he said to me, "Well, Rick betrayed me first." And I was like, "Well, he did? You know, how did that happen?" And he kind of smiled and he said, "That's your next movie, Mark. You know, I'm not at liberty to discuss it now." And who knows, you know, what he was talking about there. The conversation, and with Alex massaging it, started to open up. You started to realize that what Rick had described, and Cornell and Ollie and others, there was this father-son relationship.
They were tight,
and there was an affection. You know, it wasn't just a business relationship. You started to see him loosen up a little, and he even said something about Rick about how one of the extraordinary things about Rick was that he could quell the violence. And he remembered a scene where, you know, somebody was hot-headed and wanted to go out and shoot, you know, and Rick brought the whole thing down, and how valuable that was to this business enterprise to have somebody who really knew it's all about business. It's not about red or blue. It's about the green. Mm-hmm. So he really he opened up on that. And then we got to, I guess, what I would call the revelation, or the moment that he did reveal something, which was in 1986 in the film we have, you know, there was this, there were these busts, this 14 raids here, and Juarez, the law enforcement character, was part of that mission to get Blandone, to get his whole network, and they came up empty-handed. And there was always a suspicion. They were tipped off. They had the feds either tipped them off, they had a mole in there, and it was after that that the feds came and took all the evidence, and that the focus started to go to Rick and the street dealers, not to the suppliers. And so I kind of laid that out to him, which is in Gary Webb's book, and you know, that was always a very important chapter. And I said, you know, obviously you guys had the inside word, you were protected. And he just looked at me and a big grin. He didn't even try to deny it.
Yeah.
You know, I took that as he just acknowledged, yes. So that was a unique moment for me. I felt it was, you know, as I told you, I knew Gary, not well, but he was up at my studio when he died. I felt, you know, just tremendous sadness. And I, like many others, and like Rick says in the film, where the immediate reaction was, you know, somebody got him, you know.
You just couldn't believe it.
I have come to believe, and I have both sides in the film, that he did kill himself, but it was kind of because of all these forces. He was driven out, as the movie Kill the Messenger portrays. But I felt the weight of that to try to, in some way, continue the story that he had put out there that had been discredited by mainstream media, but that now, I think, is accepted. And even in our film, you do see the scene where Jesse Katz, who was a journalist, you know, who first did the major story on Rick, King of Crack, but then was part of the LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post kind of condemning of Gary and basically discrediting Gary, and how on camera, again, I think this was the first, Jesse said basically that was one of the low points in his career as a journalist, and he regrets you know, that he was part of really the discrediting of Gary Webb, and that Gary's instincts were right on target, and basically his basic thesis was correct.
Yeah. And I want to actually do two things before I know we have to wrap it up, because I do have a track three, and where there is a description, interesting description, of Blandon. Let's go to that clip now.
He basically laced us. He put our boots on, money count machine, weapons, low profile, the whole nine. We just worked our way up to the top of the food chain, basically.
Blandon was always a very nice man. He was actually very soft-spoken. He wasn't about a lot of bling. He was very intelligent. He was formally educated, which is, he differs from any of the other people that I know in that he was formally educated. I was 13, and on the weekends, I would go and count money for my uncle. I asked him, well, what's this all for? And he kind of filled me in on that their families were very prominent in the government in Nicaragua. And when the Sandinistas came in, they were ousted.
There was a revolution. Sandinista took over. You know, there was a counter-revolution, which was sponsored by the United States. Reagan was in power, and Reagan was anti-communist.
They are counter-revolutionary, and God bless them for being that way. And I guess that makes them Contras, and so it makes me a Contra, too.
They had to support themselves, and how did they support themselves? Drugs into the U.S.
They basically were supporting the Contras and not trafficking in drugs because that was a cool thing to do or because that was their childhood dream, but because they were patriots. They wanted their country back, and for no other reason.
So there you have it, an interesting description there of Blandon being described as aristocratic and as a patriot and wanting to take his country back, and the voice of Ronald Reagan, you know, basically identifying with the Contras. Our guest is Mark Levin, producer, director, writer of the brand new film, his brand new film, Freeway, Crack in the System. So you went to Nicaragua, you met Blandon, and did you get that glimpse of him that was just described?
I did. He is well-educated. He definitely came. In fact, his family, you know, was one of the more powerful families in Nicaragua. He did say one last thing I remember when I was leaving that I thought was interesting. He said, you know, we were just a pebble. We were just a little rock, and I thought that was interesting. He said, little rock, it looks like a piece of crack. Yeah. But meaning that, you know, they blamed it all on us, and obviously there were hundreds of tons of cocaine coming into this country. I think, though, again, what makes it unique is the convergence. He happened to be in this place when all this other stuff and connecting with Rick, and some of it was chance, which is why this story is so powerful. And now the woman who was talking in that clip you just played, she's
queen of crack,
Coral Baca. She has never spoken publicly about these issues.
Wow.
She is the source for Gary Webb. She's the original source. That's how the story started. And so that's another element of the film, is that for the first time she gives us some of what brought her into the story, how she saw the story, she's a fascinating woman also. Part of what draws people is, okay, you can hear the first time. You want to know how Gary Webb started? You want to know how this story started? here's the woman who first called him. And in the film, if you remember, we have the exchange, which is also in Kill the Messenger, of Gary, of course, once somebody says, oh, well, you haven't heard this story. You know, my friend is working for the U.S. government as a drug dealer.
Gary is like, yeah, right.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, the CIA. I've heard that one before. Exactly. Yeah. And she kind of got a little offended. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, let me show you. And then when she showed him the secret grand jury testimony, which, you know, she had gotten, and he couldn't believe how she had gotten it, that's what led him to Blandone, and that's what led him down here to Freeway Rick Ross, was reading that federal secret grand jury testimony that Coral Baca had and shared with him. That's how the story started.
Just looking at the time, it has flown by, and we are going to have to wrap things up. But before doing that, I just wanted to play one more short clip, because it's Ricky Ross talking to students at Crenshaw High School. Let's go to that right now.
I believe that no matter what obstacles they put in front of me, I'm not going to let them stop me. I'm going to keep going. You knock me down, I'm going to get up. I ain't going to lay on the floor. If you kick me, I'm going to roll over and then get up. See, a lot of times with a lot of people, if they get hit, they lay down and they stop. They don't get up. But you got to get up. You can't stay there. Anything that's worth having is hard. Don't believe when people tell you that it's supposed to be easy. See, because the easiest dope deal I ever did, guess what happened to it? Can anybody guess what the easiest dope deal got me? In jail. The easiest dope deal I ever did sent me to prison. Because my partner, he called me. I ain't selling dope no more.
Well, Mark Levin, producer, director of Freeway Cracking the System, I thought that would be a good way to wrap up our conversation. Freeway Ricky Ross saying, when you're down, you got to get on up.
Absolutely, and I appreciate the time, and I would just finish it up with cracking the system, you know, obviously refers to a variety of things. One is obviously crack, the effect.
It's a great name, great title. You came up with that?
Yes, I did. Because the other side is the crack that allows you to peek into how the system really works. And I think that's what this story, for me, and what when you asked at the beginning, what attracted me, is that this gives us a glimpse into this behemoth, this beast, this leviathan of a crazy system and how it actually operates. So I hope people take advantage, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, Mark Levin, thank you for joining us.
You got it.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Mark Levin for joining us. I'd like to thank Daniel Voll for his help with today's show and the entire Sojourner Truth team, our engineer, and of course, our assistant producer. Love to hear from you. You could email me directly if you'd like a copy of
this
today's show.
This is Norma Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.